Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And coming up soon, like starting tomorrow, the annual Resonance fundraiser from Saturday the 11th until Sunday the 19th of February 2017. Do go to fundraiser.resonance.com. .fm for information on how to donate, give, buy at auction, attend events such as Monday the 13th at Kansas Smitty's on Broadway in Hackney, the Wavelength Roadshow, starting, doors open at 7, and it starts with a DJ set from DJ Hybridist. And Adam Fisher, the extreme commuter from Leicester. Then we have a film screening by David Lester, who will present his own film Blinder and found footage. Leading on nicely to Adam Bowman and Clive Graham. And the headline act is Bob Parks and his amazing conceptual rhythm and blues band, all at Kansas Smitty's on Broadway, London E8. But today's guest is Jim Pennington. Good afternoon, Jim.
Hi.
You came on last time with William Burroughs, I think. Curse Go Back.
Yes, he wasn't there personally, but
no,
his presence
is all pervading.
Yeah.
So,
Clive was there.
Indeed, yes. So, Jim Pennington, you are the publisher and founder of Alo's Books, is that correct?
Yeah, me and Alan Fisher.
Right, the poet.
The poet, Alan Fisher, and artist, poet-artist.
Are you a poet-artist?
Not very well, no, thank you.
But sort of, slightly.
Sort of. I'm sure I do things which are creative.
Yeah, I think
enough to qualify.
Haven't I seen your name on poetry pamphlets? Wouldn't I have come across a Jim Pennington sort of concrete poem or something?
There are really obscure entries in old book catalogues, mainly with a magazine called the Brighton Head and Freak magazine, where I had a couple of pages of juvenilia, I call it.
How long ago is that? How long ago were you a
72.
Juvenile?
I was a juvenile. I'm still a juvenile, unfortunately.
Okay. I can tell you're not a juvenile anymore. You're not, come on.
I never properly grew up. I think that's why I'm not a captain of industry.
Right. Okay. So your juvenilia period was in 72.
Yeah, 60s. 69, 70, 71, yeah. 72. And then I was doing, I managed to learn how to run a printing machine.
Right.
And that's where I, how I earned a living.
You earned a living from it? That's an achievement.
In those days you could, especially if you were at the beginning of the transition from letterpress to litho.
Uh-huh.
We were about, in terms of the businesses I've been in, and we were about sort of 10 years after that. But where we were successful in was in our ability to keep abreast of the reproduction technology that used computers.
Oh, really? Okay.
You know, I was in print before even the Mac had been invented.
Yeah.
So having that come along when you're in the printing trade and being able to get to use that kind of equipment meant that we were quite successful as a...
But did you have experience of printing before you set up your own press?
No, it was just contiguous. Well, apart from running something that Bill Butler had at the Unicorn. And
In Brighton. Right.
And then the first books that we did for Alo's were some pamphlets. There was a really nice Jack Spicer one called Lament for the Maker. And that we printed on an AB Dick 320, I think it was. That was a model number desktop litho in the Arts Lab when it was in when it was in Prince of Wales Crescent.
Oh, really? Okay.
And it had moved there from
when was
Robert
this?
Street. This was 69, 70.
Right.
71. It's sort of round in that little band. I can't remember exactly.
Yeah.
It was certainly when I was living in London, having moved to London, when I went to the Poly in Kentish Town in 67.
Right.
67.
So what drove you to start a press rather than writing or doing your own thing? Why did you sort of...
I was better at running a press than I was writing.
Okay.
So that's what drove. And you were able to make a living being a printer.
Right.
And when I say being a printer, the other transition, there was the transition from letterpress to litho. There was also a transition from printers who were printers because they'd been through an apprenticeship scheme, i.e. they'd started when they were 16, but yeah. and I didn't start until I was 20, I suppose. 26, yeah, 23, 24.
Right.
So I didn't do any apprenticeship, and it was very difficult to get into the print trade if you weren't part of the union.
Oh, right, right.
And the unions, in some respects, missed a trick by not opening out their membership to small offset printing units where people could learn how to run a printing machine quite easily because they were...
But presumably, I mean, I'm guessing from looking at your sort of CV, as it were, you weren't really trying to break into mainstream publishing anyway, were you?
No.
I mean, you were very uncompromising... sort of anarchic publications?
I would say just lazy, actually.
Oh, okay.
Marketing.
Should we move on quickly? Okay, no.
No, it was mainly there came a point, actually, when I worked out that if we were going to if I was going to do publishing as making a living, you had to publish a hell of a lot more books than we were doing.
Oh, right, okay. Surely your choice of publication was very focused on
completely defined by taste and interest.
Not commercial interest.
There was a level of commerciality when I did the Pynchon pamphlets.
Thomas Pynchon.
Yeah.
Okay, right.
Because certainly when the first one sold so... Well, I say sold well, a couple of thousand copies.
Right. Okay.
And I thought, well, actually, just get on and do it.
Yeah.
Do some other ones. And they effectively financed the ones which only sold a couple of hundred, if that.
Right. Right.
Very nice little pamphlet by Ron Padgett and. Ron Padgett and.
Not Joe Brainard.
No. Who else was it?
Jim Dine.
No, Ron Padgett and somebody else did the... Was it Schneeman?
Carolee Schneeman.
No, it wasn't Carolee Schneeman. It was George. It may have been George Schneeman who did illustrations to it.
Okay.
Padgett Schneeman. I think it was Padgett Schneeman. Sweet Pea, it's called.
Right. So that was one of yours, because he did things with the Trigram Press as well.
He did, yeah.
Yeah.
But mainly he was publishing in America with the person who did Zed magazine. Well, it's just loads of Zeds.
Right.
That one? Terrible.
Yeah, can't remember that one. I'm not sure about that one.
It's not Clayton Escherman.
Not Tully Kupferberg.
No, his was Peace Press.
He's C-Press or something.
C-Press, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, skip. My memory's gone blank on that one.
That's okay. So you have that was the Arts Lab, which would have been sort of film screenings, Robert Street, Bob Cobbing, etc.
Nice Ballard exhibition there, actually.
Right.
Around that time.
Yeah.
With Crash Cars.
Oh, yeah.
And at one time, they had an exhibition there where lots of artists set up their desks, so to speak, their working desks. Uh-huh. And Ballard's, he set his up in a post box, in a phone booth.
Right.
So and you could go in there and you could see his typewriter, his manuscripts, and what he was working on at the time, or had been working on, and let it go to be displayed there.
Yeah.
It was extraordinary. Can't remember who else was there. I just remember the Ballard one, thinking, gosh, this is extraordinary. I'm actually looking at pieces of paper that Ballard was working on. There was some pages from Crash, actually.
Right, right.
Well, that had just been published, I think. It was a nice exhibition.
Okay.
The Crash Cars one was... I remember seeing about it. Apparently the opening was an extraordinary one because it there was... Ballard hired a lady to take her kit off, take her top off, at least, and go around handing the drinks.
Okay.
Handing drinks around. And this was the only thing that the people who reviewed it in the Times think of talking about.
Okay, so was this the start of the ALOS Press? Okay. You're still going? It's still producing?
I've done a couple of things with an artist called Alexander Adams.
Right.
And little booklets done on... It's only revived itself because I've revived a couple of Gestetner Mimeo machines.
Uh-huh.
Just out of a bizarre sense of... I never ran one of these before. I wonder what it's like. And I know perfectly well now why people preferred to use desktop Leica, because it really is the most...
it's not this sort of hand... I see you doing something with your hand as though you have to... Is it a mechanical process?
Yes, you could. I find it easier to use the... turn it by hand.
Yeah.
Fortunately, the runs are quite short, actually, so you're only turning the handle about 100 times before you take off the stencil. They are electric, but the problem with them is that the ink doesn't dry very well on the papers that you have that are made nowadays.
Okay.
And if it doesn't dry, then you get this set off from the ink sheet that comes down on top. And if you try to do it mechanically, there's a device that you can be fitted to the machine which drops a piece of card on top of the sheet that's just come out, so the next sheet doesn't catch the ink off of it.
Right.
Interleaving it is.
Well, like a sort of blotting paper thing.
It's like a blotting paper, Right. And it, although it's quite a thick card, it's actually just a separator rather than a blotting paper.
Okay.
And the problem with that particular device is that it's not always, especially if you're running paper that is foolscap, the full 13 inches, it doesn't fall exactly at the same time every time.
Right.
And if it doesn't fall exactly at the same time every time, then the next sheet coming out gets caught, and then you get a screw up, sort of sheets crunching each other. And if you're running the machine on the if you've turned a switch on and it's running on the electric motor, it's very difficult to get in there and stop it in time before. Whereas if you're doing it by hand, you really are in touch with the
like
paper
the old,
and the
old
machine. You can feel the machine telling you
things.
Well,
Bob Cobbing used to make a feature, didn't he, or made a virtue out of the sort of defects of a Xerox machine. But he literally moved the paper whilst it was being scanned or whatever, and create these sort of images which were almost like smeared photocopies, and that was the sort of art of it in a way.
He also did some of Cobbing's, those expanses of ink smears and whatever are the backing sheet on a Gestetner Mimeo, which you put it onto the used stencil just to keep it square and straight. When you take it off, you get a delightful pattern, actually.
Right. So there is room for kind of what exploiting the glitches or what most people would see as the downside of using such technology, which is probably lacking.
I think you're clutching at aesthetic straws there.
Am I?
Actually, yes.
Okay. Well, perhaps we should get on with what we're actually here to talk about, which is Paul Bowles.
Yeah.
You proposed Paul Bowles as today's topic, and so you've done extensive research on this subject.
I picked up a book this morning, that I remember that I had.
I got the biography out of the library about 2 days ago, and I've sort of got through the introduction, so I'm going to lean heavily on your knowledge here of Paul Bowles. Why Paul Bowles? Why are we doing Paul Bowles today?
I think because he's a fascinating sort of... They call him a kind of alma mater? He was influential.
Right.
Although one can't work out why, because his prose is as conventional as it comes.
Really? Okay. Yes, but he was part of that Beat sort of clique,
well,
wasn't
no,
he
wasn't no? even that, actually. No? He was far superior to the Beats. There's a bit of intellectual, not prudery, intellectual snobbism that I think went with his, where he functioned in that literary world.
We should mention his background. Strangely, you know, one of the few things I did learn was that he had a background in music.
Oh.
He was a quite an accomplished composer before the writing. And in fact, if you go to YouTube, you can find all sorts of clips of his music. And didn't he study under Virgil Thompson and Aaron Copland?
Study under them? I thought he studied with them.
Well, I think they were his sort of mentors, I think. I don't know. I think he'd been to Paris, and I think he came back, and somebody introduced him to Copland, and, you know, Copland was sort of suitably impressed with what he'd done and so on. But I stand to be corrected on that. But we're not going to play any Bowles music today, are we?
I haven't got any, no.
Right, okay.
In fact, I've heard very little of it.
Right.
It's piano. I've heard so little of it. It would be rude of me to even begin to describe it.
Okay, but so we're leaving aside his career as a composer, and so we start with his writing period, which was roughly when.
I didn't bone up on him that much, actually.
I'll leave it to you. We can get the tape running, can't we?
Run the tape. Let's hear his voice. He's a nice reader.
Yeah. I just happened to, completely by chance, I picked up this tape many years ago with a bunch of cassettes. And it's called Baptism of Solitude. And it is the first release from Bill Laswell's Meta label, and it's a rare recording of Paul Bowles reading passages from his greatest works, which include The Sheltering Sky, Let It Come Down, The Spider's House, Up Above the World, The Distance Episode, and many other things. The disadvantage with this is, but being a cassette, we can't actually, it's, you know, difficult to single out any tracks, so we're just going to have to let it run, I think. And this is
slowly on the sandy shore. It was comforting to be this close to the surface of the ocean and gaze at the intimate nocturnal details of its swelling and ebbing. And as she listened to the faraway breakers rolling up onto the beach, she became aware of another sound entwined with the intermittent crash of waves, a vast horizontal whisper across the bosom of the sea, carrying an ever-repeated phrase, regular as a lighthouse flashing.
Dawn will be breaking soon. Well, I assume from the cassette running order that this is from The Sheltering Sky. Does it?
Again and again.
And this the soundtrack behind this is provided by Bill Laswell, it seems.
Blank look as to
you come across Bill Laswell?
I have, yes. He throws his backing tracks onto loads of other people's work.
Yeah,
he did it with Burroughs. I'm not a keen admirer of interfering with the writer reading.
Right. It turns it into a sort of almost like a movie, doesn't it?
But yeah, something. I don't know. I mean, we haven't heard all of that yet.
No.
You certainly can't hear the crisp.
That seems to be the end of that track.
The head is where the cricket sings. The cheeks are what the teeth will bite. The lake is where the lover flings the other in the dead of night. The lips are where the blood goes in. The eyes are what the fingers claw. Knowing now what might have been, will the lips tell what the eyes saw?
Wow. That is
short little poem.
Yes, I suppose that's from Let It Come Down.
I'd say that was from a book of poems.
Okay.
Immediately when you arrive in the Sahara, for the first or the tenth time, you notice the stillness. An incredible absolute silence prevails outside the towns and within, even in busy places like the markets. There's a hushed quality in the air, as if the quiet were a conscious force, which, resenting the intrusion of sound, minimizes and disperses.
So tell me, what's your connection with bowls then, Jim? What are you kind of?
I read the books in the late 60s, 70s, and was intrigued by them, obviously,
right. Yeah.
And intrigued by the fact that I could that he lived in Tangiers. And if I drove down there, I could knock on his door and say hello. It's right. Not quite like that. We did. Eric Mottram, who was another of the people we published in Allers, he'd done an essay called Staticity and Terror, which was, I think, the very one, again, once, I say again, because Mottram also did the very first, so we call it academic literary study of Burroughs, Algebra of Need. And I believe Staticity and Terror is... again, the first academic literary study by Eric in the UK, because he was the one that introduced English literature to American literature, something like that.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, we did a book of Eric's.
Right.
And we did Staticity and Terror.
So you have the pamphlet with you in front of you.
Yeah, this is
Eric Mottram's pamphlet, published when, 76?
76.
By your press, the ALOS press.
Yeah. Yeah, I remember printing it on an R30, Rotoprint Theatre 30. The cover design is based on a Baedeker travel guide.
Right.
Sort of rather pathetic joke, but still.
It works. It's quite at odds with the title, isn't it? It's hardly a travel guide.
Yeah.
I mean, it's called Staticity.
And Terror, yeah. I'm not quite... Eric can be a little bit opaque, especially to a simple mind like mine. But there is a... running through the study is the concept of stasis.
Right.
And you'll have to read it to find out what that is. I'm not too sure myself.
Okay.
But it goes with terror.
Right.
And
do you want to read a bit from it? Or?
I'm looking at it, but if I read anything from it, it'll be just so out of context.
Yeah.
turn balls up at the moment.
It's quite strong enough for him. No other surroundings can provide a supremely satisfying sensation of existing in the midst of something that is absolute. He will go back, whatever the cost in comfort and money, for the absolute has no price.
You see, Paul Bowles knew that the irrational controlled at least as much as the social and the political. Experience of relinquishing power to another under hypnosis of Majoun and of the Jalali told him as much at first hand. Tangiers chose him as the city of his permanent residence, and he has stayed there. I relish the idea that in the night all around me in my sleep, sorcery is burrowing its invisible tunnels in every direction, from thousands of senders to thousands of unsuspecting recipients. He had... That's me. I thought I'd left my mobile behind.
And the orchards. And when these have caught upon the wing, each wing that flutters from the
your
sky...
Your mobile has found you.
Then
okay. Shall I rip out the turn it off, OK.
Somebody from the other side, perhaps.
Transform the minnows into hawks, tarantulas and bees. Okay. Then shall I unmake each whining thing.
OK. Well, you were reading from the Eric Mottram pamphlet.
Yeah. And it's intriguing to see how... what's most of all intriguing about Bowles is the fact he lived in Tangiers, and that's where he kind of settled. He never never went anywhere else apart from his island off Ceylon that he bought in the mid-60s,
right.
When you could buy islands off Ceylon.
Yeah.
I say... an island. I think it was effectively like buying a piece of land that had some water around it when the tide was in.
Okay.
They qualified as an island.
All right.
And it was quite near the mainland. Yeah. So it wasn't like
He spent time in Paris, didn't he? I mean, in his youth, he travelled to Paris and spent...
He did a lot of time in Paris.
Hung out with all the usual kind of, and I think Berlin, he was, you know, he tangled, you know, there was the usual sort of Isherwood connection, and then there was moved on to the Gertrude Stein and a few
Stein,
of these people.
That's the one, yeah.
And then back to America, I think.
But finally he ended up in Tangiers and stayed there.
What do you think drew him to Tangiers then? Was he the first one of that team to go there? I call them team. We know we're talking Burroughs, Ginsberg, Ferlinghetti.
It was before them. It was a place of escape for literary and artistic people ever since, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know. When did that start? Certainly, probably when people were able to travel relatively easily.
Right.
So probably from the mid 19th century.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's a book about the literary world of Tangiers that will show you people were living there in the starting from the mid 19th century. I'm trying to Henry Fielding, I think, had a go there once.
Okay.
But he was certainly the first of the modern writers. There was around him. There were those that Rupert Croft Cooke was in there living there, but he would have come later. Probably he was one of the first to establish himself there and enjoy living there.
Right.
I think sometimes the writers really didn't enjoy living there because they spent most of their time in the European sector,
right,
grumbling about the natives.
Yeah. Should we mention that his wife was with him, Jane Bowles, poet?
Yes. Poet, better writer than a poet.
Right.
Her books I found more interesting than Bowles's sometimes. Again, her writing, there's nothing terribly experimental.
No.
At all. Not that experimenting in writing is absolutely essential for it to be interesting, she was the personal life of Paul Bowles is interesting enough, actually, and it's no small wonder he stuck to.
In what sense? How is that interesting?
Well, he and they never had children. Okay,
right.
And he and his gay life was. Was certainly easy to follow in Tangiers, as was as was Jane Bowles's gay life as well. Although it must have been more difficult for
right.
Well, they had such a structured society there in terms of what women did and what men did.
Okay.
And
the drugs.
And the drugs. Although mostly with Paul Bowles anyway, it was smoking and eating majun. Which
apparently he experimented with ether very early on, didn't he?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Apparently that was one of his like school events. He sort of did this stuff with ether and sort of. Was, you know, cleared the assembly hall by sort of the fumes of ether kind of exuded all over the place. So I think he was an experimenter with ether and alcohol probably before he even got to Morocco.
Yeah, I guess. I didn't know that, but he...
I assume that was part of his, you know, why they all banded together, the like Burroughs, Ginsberg and Bowles. I imagine this was something they had in common.
expanding their consciousness, yes. Although they used different drugs to do it.
Right.
I don't think Paul Bowles ever did anything class A, shall we call it.
Okay.
If he did, it's not mentioned,
right,
and not talked about. And he never took enough of it to become a controlling factor within the way he wrote or what he did. Unlike with Burroughs,
yeah.
With Jane Bowles, who I'm sure was eating as much majun and smoking as many Keith cigarettes as Paul did, slightly different thing there because she had this strange relationship with her with Sharifa, her partner, Moroccan partner, who she was almost certainly a witch of some nature, I don't know whether there are degrees of witchiness.
Okay.
She was only a little bit of a witch.
Right.
I'm sure she was a major witch, and she'd cast spells and make it unpleasant for people by surreptitiously taking some of their toenails and showing it to a grasshopper.
Yes.
And then the people would fall over, hop in the air and fall over, stuff like that.
Okay. You make it sound entirely plausible.
Well, they believed it. This is a weird thing. You see, people like Geisel believed it so much so that he started casting spells in his restaurant. I read somewhere recently.
He had a restaurant?
Geisel had, yeah.
Did he? I didn't know that. Where was this?
It was in Tangiers. It was called Thousand Nights.
Yeah.
It was called The Thousand and One. Some people say it was called The Thousand and One Nights.
Yeah.
Actually, it was in French. It was called Mille.
So if he took against the customer, he'd curse.
No, it was against his workers.
Okay.
It was against the cooks who were cooking the wrong food.
Ended up working on his own. Then. Yeah.
Well, he did. No, a very strange story with his restaurant that he was sort of effectively hounded out of it by a couple of really early Scientologists called Mary Cook, Mary and John Cook. This is mid-50s, so we're talking early Scientology, early manipulations by that organisation.
Yeah.
And I think they really wanted the money. That's they I don't know what happened to the restaurant afterwards. Whether certainly they didn't then become John and Mary Cook didn't become the new John and Fanny Craddock.
Right. they had the right name, didn't they?
Cool. Yeah. Yes, okay. They did. No, okay. they were so, the John and Fanny Craddock.
So Jane Bowles is some sort of witch then. We have her cast as a
witch. Her partner was a witch. And she subscribed to the witchiness.
I see.
And then she had a terrible stroke, and then ended up in a home in Spain.
Right.
Yeah, Malaga.
Well, tell me about you actually met Paul Bowles on two occasions. Is this because you went to Tangiers to visit him, or you met him somewhere else? Or?
We went to Tangiers because we went to the Jujuka Festival.
Which is what?
Jujuka is a village about 50 or 60 miles south of Tangiers in the foothills of the mountain range there. And it's a village that became isolated at the time when Morocco was split up into the various international zones, and it became isolated because they were the musicians. It was a village which consisted entirely of musicians, except for the ones that people who lived there went and worked on the fields. Entirely musicians, and they were musicians to the court of the King of Morocco. When it got all zoned up. When was that? Historically, sort of.
56?
It was after the Second World War, yeah.
It was 56, I think.
Yeah.
Because they were worried, weren't they, about becoming, that it would no longer be an international something or other.
Yeah. So it gets zoned up, and they weren't able to travel to the court of the king any longer, which meant that they lost their means of livelihood in terms of. But that's kind of irrelevant to the fact that they were in Jujuka. That was their village, because they had one of the genres of music that they played was a music, djilele, a music of healing. And that village had a particular saint, Islamic saint, called Sidi Amechtria, who was, his job was curing people. Mm. He was dead, but he had a shrine there.
Right.
His shrine did the curing.
Yeah.
And they would play this music, and they would, mad people would come there, and they'd be tied to a tree and have music played for hours on end.
To heal them or to punish them?
Most healing is punishment. Have you not noticed?
But to tie them to a tree, it doesn't sound entirely voluntary. It's sort of,
well, no, otherwise.
Is this the place where Brian Jones went and made,
yeah,
this,
that's
made,
the one.
Made,
yes,
this legendary...
Yeah. Now, he's another one who wouldn't let the music speak for itself. Like, Laswell gets hold of Paul Reading there and, yeah, has to put crank in some music, background music to it.
Yeah.
Although, fortunately, that little line of poetry, those few lines of poetry, didn't have any,
right,
real music background. I think there was some noise, some sea sound onto it. But, yeah, yeah, well, yeah, so Brian Jones insisted on taking his recordings and phasing them up and down.
Okay.
So what you hear on that record isn't exactly the...
it's not pure.
It's not the pure sound,
okay,
which is extraordinary, I can tell you.
Right.
If you've got 20 people all playing their writer, this kind of reeded flute, loud, yeah,
yeah,
in a room, shall we say, just twice the size of this studio,
yeah,
with rock walls, it is extraordinary. And there's a bloke doing some polyrhythmic drumming, several blokes doing polyrhythmic drumming in the background.
Right. Okay, so this is, you went there?
Yeah, we went there. Okay. We arrived late for the actual festival. They have a particular festival... for when it's 2 months after Ramadan finishes, and it's called Boujaloud, and it consists of lots of music being played, and someone dresses up in a sheepskin, goat skin, a recently deceased goat. So, okay, I mean, the blood was still on the pelt.
Right.
The pelt was still wet. It hadn't dried or anything. They slaughter the goat. The young boy, it's usually a young boy, chosen for his ability to stay awake, I think, actually, because he has to do this non-stop for 48 hours, running around, dancing and getting tranced up with the music and finding as many young girls as he can to whip with a broom made from probably olive, actually.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, something, it doesn't matter what it is. If you were touched with it, then you would become pregnant the next year or whatever. There's a fertility.
Oh,
right?
Okay.
It's all over the place. I've seen it in weddings in Egypt,
right,
where the same thing, not because it's slightly more sophisticated in an Egyptian wedding. They have... they don't have a bloke dressed up in a goat skin. This guy's wearing a proper kind of fez and proper dress and whatever. He goes around trying to.
So is this where you met Paul Bowles then?
Yeah, not at the festival. When we went down there, we knocked on. We'd just done Statisti, actually, and so I took copies down for him.
Right.
And we sat in his apartment, and Larby was sitting in the corner chopping up some keef. And there was some music. If we get that tape, that thing that I brought in there was...
Yeah.
I plonked my...
Okay, so this is a tape you brought in.
Yeah.
We'll just get this going, and then maybe you can tell me what this is. So is this a recording you made?
Yes, I can't remember where this was. I think it was in the cafe in Tangiers.
Right. What sort of recording equipment would you have had, just as a matter of interest?
Panasonic thing where you press some buttons at the top and built-in mic.
Right.
This is not your territory.
So this is, okay. This is just in a cafe in Tangier?
Yeah.
This is nothing to do with this Jujuka?
No.
No.
Yes. This is somewhere in a cafe somewhere. In a couple of minutes' time, we'll be in Paul Bowles' flat.
Oh, okay. Well, we'll just let it run.
Yeah.
And why were you seeking him out then, particularly? Why did you sort of choose to? You must have focused. You just thought, I'm going to go to Tangiers and find Paul Bowles. Or did you have other motives for being there?
That's a ligger. I'm a ligger.
But you chose
a literary groupie.
Okay, but you chose to lig onto Paul Bowles.
Well, because he's a beautifully existentialist, slightly depressing writer. You know, it's fantastic to read stuff like that.
So you revered him. He was a sort of an idol of yours at the time. What should we call him? An influence.
He was certainly influential in the way one thought about how depressing the world can be. It's just really exciting finding a fellow mind,
right,
to encourage one's sense of desperation at the as one's existence.
Okay. Why was he there, do you think? I mean, I think I've asked this already, but is it as though there's the essence of something there? It's like you have to go to the edge of the desert or whatever it is that draws you to this area in order to... does it confirm your desperation, or it gives you peace or something?
I blame doing French A level and having to read Albert Camus, actually.
Okay.
So and then having done French A level, I did VSO, and I was
voluntary service overseas.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
And I did a year in Algeria in a small school south of Algiers.
So you've been there already then? You'd already been
in North Africa?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'd caught the sun. Simple as that.
So, okay.
African sunstroke, it's called. North African sunstroke.
Right. But then, you go back, you're in search of Paul Bowles now. And does he accept you then? Does he sort of say,
had a procession of visitors and he accepted everybody. He was incredibly generous with his time. Uh-huh. And, yeah, and I think, you know, that the publishing interest in him was, and Eric's essay.
You took that with you?
Yeah, we took that with us that time, and he was very pleased to see it.
Right.
And we swapped books, gave him a couple of his books. A really nice thing printed in Nepal by Next to Nothing, it's called, printed on bamboo paper, bamboo-y sort of rice paper.
Right.
By Ira Cohen.
Okay.
There were some other people in the room as well. I can't remember who they were, though. I was sure one was Margaret Mead, but I'm told it wasn't Margaret Mead.
Uh-huh.
She was called Margaret. They were very well-spoken American travellers. And, yeah, I'm sure he had a procession of people visiting him.
Yeah.
And, yeah, because in those days you knocked on his door. We did write beforehand.
Yeah.
And he wrote beforehand, told him we'd be in town
during
that time. And so it wasn't a complete surprise that we were there.
But you met him twice. When was the second time?
Second time, I may be actually wrong in thinking that I met him twice. I don't know. I may just be conflating two visits at the same period.
Right, okay.
But one mustn't forget that one was smoking a lot of stuff.
I was going to say, I didn't want to.
I'm surprised I could remember bloody anything, actually.
Okay.
But I do remember sitting in that apartment. And the bloke chopping Keith in the background, or the other end of the sofa. The two American people sitting opposite. And in the... over on the left, through the sliding doors, was the balcony, which was completely closed in, because he had, about 3,000 canaries living there. It was just a lot of canaries singing in the background. It was delightful, actually.
Right.
And some music playing in the background.
Right. When was this? Which year was this?
It should have been
roughly
74 to 76 somewhere, because we didn't do the book until 76.
Yeah. Were you hoping to publish something of his or reprint
something? I did want to
something?
Do something else, but he didn't have anything. Okay. I didn't... and I wasn't... That wasn't the prime reason for meeting him. It was just sort of... getting a little bit... Getting some of the dope on Jujuka as well.
Right.
And he confirmed this story that he... That the festival where they have the... Bougelude come out as a fertility thing is derives from a really early pantheistic tradition, pre-Islamic tradition of fertility rites and pipes of Pan. That's it.
Okay.
And he confirmed that. But funnily enough, he never actually recorded up there. I don't think.
No,
he did a lot of recordings of Arabic Arab native music.
All right.
Financed by the one of them Smithsonian, probably.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And this is the music that was playing. I mean, I don't recognise it. Is it? Philip Glass?
You were trying to work out before. So this is now in his flat?
Yeah, yeah.
In Tangiers?
Yeah.
In the 70s?
Yeah.
Perhaps some eagle-eared listener will recognise this, and then they can tell me afterwards.
Like Captain Marvel.
Yes, hand-cut by Tibetan cross, and naturally.
It doesn't sound like Philip Glass. It's too kind of. It's not really minimal, is it? It goes up and down. It's very. I don't know.
What is it?
Is it Henry Cowell, perhaps? I'll guess that. I don't really know. I'm going to guess at Henry Cowell. If anyone, a listener, can identify the piano music in the background here, then please...
get a prize.
You will get a prize. Like, yes, I'll give you a prize if you can identify it. Just email wavelength at resonance. Just so it settles our argument. So who's this? Can we hear... Is this Paul Bowles himself speaking?
Yeah. Come here, love. She feels much hungry.
He's talking in Spanish to Larbi.
Right.
Todo el diablo, ¿no?
Sí.
So.
I think Larbi may have been liquidizing the key. May have been chopping the key for the liquidizer.
Who's Larbi again?
Mohamed Larbi, a Moroccan writer.
Oh, okay. Right.
And I think his book that Paul Bowles translated was called For Bread Alone, I think.
All right.
Maybe wrong there, I can't. Maybe that was Shukri.
It makes a nice lampshade.
This is such a bad recording, I don't think it should be played, actually. My conversation...
It's very atmospheric. It is the real thing. You just left the tape running whilst you were in
there. I just left the tape running, yeah. No sound level check, mate.
Okay. I'll just go to make a quick announcement. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. Today's guest is Jim Pennington, publisher of ALO's books, and we are sort of wandering around recollections of Paul Bowles and particularly... Jim's meeting with Paul Bowles in Tangiers in the 70s, which is where this recording was made. I'm going to just make another announcement about the annual Resonance fundraiser, which runs from Saturday the 11th till Sunday the 19th of February 2017. Go to fundraiser.resonance.fm for information on how to proceed, how to make a donation or how to take part or win a prize or something. And the Wavelength Roadshow is Monday the 13th at Kansas Smitty's on Broadway, with the highlight being Bob Parks and his conceptual rhythm and blues band, which ends with a voodoo ritual, as it happens.
Uh-huh.
Yes, however brief that may be. Bob Parks went to Benin and tried to, in West Africa, he tried to get to the source of voodoo, and he's sort of well into that, and he goes to sort of gospel church meetings here as well, although he doesn't tell them that he's also some kind of voodoo initiate or something. So it's all a bit of a mixture, sort of a cocktail of something.
But voodoo is not African, though, is it? It's Caribbean.
Well, it comes from Haiti, but yeah. I think. But yes, you'd have to ask Bob about that. You'll have to come along on Monday and quiz him about that.
I'd like to. What's being auctioned at the...
Well, it's all sorts of things. If you go to the website, it's all sorts of CDs, books. Uh-huh. You could donate an ALO's pamphlet or a special edition of something, and then people would bid for it.
Yeah.
You get the name ALO's up on the website and so on. So you're welcome to donate something or even bid for something.
I shall do both.
Excellent. Thank you. All right.
Looking forward to it.
So how did it end, your excursion, your meeting with Bowles? How did it go?
It was just chit chat. There was no sort of really solid serious discussion about stuff. In fact, we were this conversation here. We were talking. He was showing me some book he'd had printed on a paper which he couldn't recognise, and we were discussing paper.
Right.
And we were also discussing the ALO's book logo, which is a book with a bite out of it. And this is because one of the first books that Dick Miller did, he was another founder of ALO's books, was a book that with Alan that they printed on rice paper, so you could actually eat the book.
Was one of these edible books actually almost poisonous?
I don't know that.
I thought there was some story, some rumour about one of them actually being not terribly good for you if you did eat it. Sounds a bit. Almost like one of these something a witch might do. But anyway,
there's something a witch might do. Ink. I mean, they did have ink on them, and ink's not they're not the most nutritious substances. There is so little ink.
All right. So did he meet? Did he come up to your expectations, Paul Bowles?
No expectations. You know, this is.
He didn't disappoint you, though.
Didn't disappoint me at all. Yeah. Okay. Just that presence. Just all them canaries as well.
Yeah.
I couldn't get that out of my.
Right.
We didn't hear him. We can't hear him on the recording because it was such a crap recording, actually. And what's he saying? I mean, this is class recording, you know. Something hits the desk, and you get a clunk.
We're talking about.
Oh, he could find his way back next time. Well, there were so many other parts of the world, so many other moments in time to be visited. He never was certain that the way back would really be there. Counting was impossible. How many hours he had been like this, lying on the burning mattress, how many times he had seen Kit stretched out on the floor nearby, had made a sound and seen her turn over, get up, and then come toward him to give him water. Things like that he could not have told, even if he had thought to ask them of himself. His mind was occupied with very different problems. Sometimes he spoke aloud, but it was not satisfying. It seemed rather to hold back the natural development of the ideas. They flowed out through his mouth, and he was never sure whether they've been resolved in the right words. Words were much...
Shouldn't be done.
This is me. This is me making notes on the tape later on in the later on that night, and probably best to fade it out. Actually, basically, the note I was making was a conversation that Paul Bowles was saying. How, in fact, that little snippet from Delicate Prey.
Is that what it is?
Yeah. Okay. I think it was from Delicate Prey, but.
Yes, you're right. Yeah. The Delicate Prey.
There were two stories when he had his first the collection of short stories published by in London by John Lemon, called A Little Stone. Two stories were left out of it: A Distant Episode and Delicate Prey, because I'm pretty sure it was them two. I made a note of this before I came out. Completely forgotten. Anyway, two stories are left out because their discussion of sexuality was deemed to be too... one of the stories is about an incestuous relationship with... a father's incestuous relationship with his son.
Right, OK.
I can't remember what other taboo subject the other story was about, but it certainly wasn't considered suitable for the London literary world. Right. And indeed, Paul Bowles said that at one stage he was told that the people who were typesetting the book wouldn't typeset it.
Right. Okay.
But this is because in those days, if there was a prosecution for libel or obscenity, whatever, the people who actually printed the book.
Yeah.
Would be sued,
would
the typesetters.
They were all deemed responsible.
Yes. I'm just surprised they didn't even prosecute the people who made the paper.
Yeah.
This is called quality control, you know, like sourcing, the QA system. You know. Yeah. You made the paper, mate. You're up for it as well.
And distinguish between them, even though he hated them both. Knew that the one which was only there was the true one, while the other was wrong. It was an existence of exile from the world. He never saw
you. So does his work stand up? Does it hold up? You're still a fan? Is it?
Well, do you know, I just picked some things up just this morning and last night, and I think they do. They should be read, certainly in the context of the relationship between Islam and the West.
Okay.
Surprisingly, nothing seems to have changed, actually.
Oh, really?
Because
Did he stay there right to the end? What happened? Where did he...
Did he die in Morocco? Or maybe they took him in the last days he went... No, I think he died in Morocco, yeah.
Right,
yeah,
okay.
He was there all the way. He was there at the critical time in Morocco when it finally got its independence. And there were these... The Spider's House is very much about this, about the nationalist movement in Morocco, where you had this merging of nationalism with Islam. But fortunately, there is the brand of Islam that runs across North Africa is an Islam which is totally integrated. Integrates itself far better with Western civilization and culture than the Islam that comes from Saudi Arabia. I'm not an expert, but that's a fairly simple observation to make.
Right.
You don't have to be an expert to make observation.
All right, well, you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and today's guest was Jim Pennington of ALO's Books, remembering his meeting with Paul Bowles. So thank you very much, Jim, for coming in. And we'll just go out with... this is Paul Bowles himself speaking. Do you know which this...
The thought in itself, he said, a gratuitous fact, like a painting of pure design. They were coming again. They began to flash by. He tried to hold one. Believed
he
had
it. What this is. It's ruined, I'm afraid, by Laswell's.
Crowding behind him. While he succumbed, struggling, he He opened his eyes for help. The room, still here. It was in the side.